From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. Parents, a language alert in this first story. In a three-part order issued last week, the Federal Communications Commission levied the largest fines ever against broadcast stations for airing what the majority deems, quote, indecent content. CBS stations felt the brunt of the blow with $3.6 million in fines for implied sexual situations involving teenagers in its primetime drama Without a Trace. This on top of $550,000 in fines for the Janet Jackson breast exposure incident during the 2004 Super Bowl. Democratic Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein dissented from large portions of the majority decision, but he stands by the government's right to protect against the most egregious trespasses, such as lewdness in front of children during family viewing hours.
Well, look, there are a lot of families gathered around the television during the Super Bowl, not expecting to see adult-type fare. Frankly, it's not that adults don't have every right to see that kind of material, but children are supposed to be protected from that, and parents had no reason to expect that during a Super Bowl they would be subject to that kind of performance, and we had over 500,000 complaints.
But do those complaints, as you analyze them, are they from a lot of individuals acting individually, or were they part of some organized AstroTurf campaign of the American Family Association or elsewhere on the religious right?
I think we see both. I mean, certainly in the case of the Super Bowl, there was a lot of grassroots concern. Without a Trace, my sense is, was much more of an organized campaign that came out of centralized organizations that are monitoring the airwaves. So it depends. But the point is that the FCC needs to look into every complaint, and we do look at every complaint and determine if only one person weighed in or if 100,000 people weighed in. We try to see whether or not the material met the standard or not.
I want to talk to you about the word bullshit. Now, this is commonly used to convey skepticism, but the commission found it to be explicitly execratory and therefore indecent, whereas dickhead, as an insult, is okay. But where I come from, bullshit is, you know, pretty much kid stuff, and dickhead is pretty darned insulting, all of which is to finally ask, I guess, how do you go about finding standards on this stuff? It just seems to me so arbitrary.
Well, are you actually going to air that, or are you going to edit that out? Because
it depends. Are you on duty?
My colleagues may have an issue with it. To me, it's something that does defy a little bit the imagination. I understand why parents don't want that heard over the airwaves, but our rules require that words that are banned are either sexual or execratory. And I think in common usage, that word is not really one that is execratory. So we made quite a stretch to say that it's inherently so. And I think it's something that is probably going to be challenged in court.
So I'll mark you down as against this portion of the ruling. But as to the general question of arbitrariness, the fact that you're having this kind of Talmudic debate about, you know, what is over the line and what isn't, doesn't that get to the central problem that there can be no reasonable standard because it's just also wildly subjective?
I think there is a real problem with the arbitrary nature of this and the fact that we don't really have a consistent way of looking at these different words as to what's indecent or profane. You look at the so-called Golden Globes case where Bono used the F word with regard to an award that he got. It wasn't certainly sexual in nature, but we found that it may have been. And once you go down that path, all of a sudden you have the whole vocabulary in front of you and you need to make these determinations. And in fact, I can see why broadcasters would be somewhat confused about what is and what isn't permissible.
Yeah, and I'm like, yeah. Now, you dissented with a specific ruling that fined the Martin Scorsese documentary, The Blues, Godfathers and Sons, writing that, quote, the coarse language is a part of the culture of the individuals being portrayed. And you equate it with a prior ruling by the commission on Schindler's List and Saving Private Ryan, which allowed graphic language to depict, quote, serious incidents.
Well, I think when it comes to news and documentaries, that we have traditionally looked at a different standard. It is very hard to separate out coarse language from the culture of the blues that was being portrayed. And I guess it was a decision by my colleagues that you could, that we somehow here inside the Beltway knew better than Martin Scorsese how to cut that film, and that you could somehow take out certain parts and not lose meaning.
So explain to me again why, instead of writing a partially concurring opinion, you didn't, you know, self-immolate on the steps of the FCC in protest of your colleagues' actions?
Well, all I can do is write a dissent in part, and that's what I did. I mean, I think we need to be very careful about how we draw the line here, because the Supreme Court gave us a real short leash on which to determine what is and isn't indecent. They want us to exercise the utmost restraint lest we inhibit the constitutional rights of broadcasters and others to free speech. If we overstep in these cases and the court knocks us down, we could potentially lose what limited authority we have to protect children from indecent material forever. It would actually take a constitutional amendment, amending the First Amendment, to be able to get the FCC authority back to limit material that we could all agree would be inappropriate for children.
All right, Commissioner. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Bob.
Jonathan Adelstein is a Democratic appointee to the FCC. Among the programs singled out by the commission, it will come as surprise to nobody, was NYPD Blue. No fines were meted out because the FCC determined that the show predated the current standards, but the majority did certify that language and situations on the show were, quote, explicit, shocking, and gratuitous. Stephen Bochco is creator of NYPD Blue and many other groundbreaking series. He joins us now. Stephen, welcome to OTM.
Thank you, Bob.
Well, it's official. NYPD Blue is indecent. What the f*** do you do now?
Well, the good news is we're not making it anymore. You know, we made 12 years of that show, and it really was only in the last 2 years, I would say, that we began to feel the sort of restrictive vice of these new broadcast standards.
Could NYPD Blue be produced today?
No. It would be a different color. It wouldn't be blue. It would be NYPD mauve or something. I don't know. Look, you know, when I used to get letters from angry viewers about NYPD Blue, my response always was, we could have told those stories without that language. We could have told those stories without the specific sexual content. It was a choice. It was a creative choice, which we always took very seriously, and we always tried to implement responsibly. But we felt that in the world in which we were telling our stories, the kind of language we used was absolutely appropriate. And the degree of sexuality that we portrayed really was about as provocative as that which you would see in a PG-13 movie.
Okay, fair enough. That's the verisimilitude argument. But, you know, there's also the titillation argument, and that is of getting people to watch just to, you know, see how far you'll go. You're not going to tell me that that never entered your thinking in the framing of a given episode of NYPD Blue or any of your other series.
That's exactly what I'm going to say to you. Obviously, we conceptualized NYPD Blue to be a show that pushed at the bindings, because in the early 1990s, the hour drama was kind of moribund on broadcast television, and cable was just having us for lunch. So in broad strokes, the mandate for NYPD Blue was to mature the medium somewhat. But there really was never any impulse to try to spin what we had into ever more provocative fare so as to attract more of an audience. We got the audience right away.
Well, clearly the FCC has decided that the pendulum has swung too far and that it has to make a correction. And, you know, this all seems, though, so 1957.
Yeah, it sure does.
Did you see this coming? Did you think it would come to this?
Yes, of course, because when I was receiving 2,000 pieces of mail a week in sacks delivered to my office protesting NYPD Blue before it ever went on the air, What you had to realize is that the FCC essentially serves at the pleasure of the administration. And as the administration in power turns more conservative, the FCC is going to be completely reflective of the philosophies of the administration. I think that's what we're dealing with now.
So you get these 2,000 letters a week in these AstroTurf efforts by organized constituencies, you know, determined to moderate your behavior. As you go through these letters, do you ever encounter one that was not part of an organized letter writing campaign, but one that was just the, you know, real life experience?
Absolutely.
That made you take pause and go, you know, maybe strictly speaking, I really didn't need to show Dennis France's ass this week. Do you ever have second thoughts?
I never needed to show anybody's ass. I never needed to show anybody's breasts. I never needed to use the word asshole. Those were creative choices. And I regret all kinds of things I've done, but I've never regretted them conceptually. I usually regret them simply because, for one reason or another, the execution wasn't good enough. You know, did we contextualize the moment sufficiently to make it appropriate?
But if you agree that the FCC should have some purview over what goes over the airwaves, then isn't it just a question of who writes the list? I mean, you and I may agree that the ruling that bullshit is indecent is bullshit, but someone has to write the rules. By what process would you determine what is over the line?
As someone who has had a fairly intimate relationship with an audience over many, many, many years, I think I have a pretty good perspective about, you know, what an audience will tolerate. And I mean, I really trust that audiences have a lot more sophistication in that regard than government watchdogs. You know, it's not so much that I object to oversight. What I think I object to is the fact that the oversight tends to shift with the wind. And you never know from one day to the next what's acceptable and what isn't.
Let me ask you one more thing.
Sure.
You're a wealthy man. You probably make more money in syndication revenue in a month than I'll earn in my entire career. So when the fines come in for this broadcast, will you cover me?
You're on your own, pal.
All right. Well, I thought I'd ask.
You won't get fined.
Stephen, thanks very much.
It's my pleasure.
Inveterate television producer Stephen Bochco spoke to us from his office in Santa Monica, California. Coming up, the so-called last dictatorship in Europe proves resistant to the opposition's media strategy and war crimes trials on trial. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. On the heels of democratic revolutions in Serbia, Ukraine, and Kyrgyzstan, hopes were high for democratic opposition in Sunday's election in Belarus, often described as the last dictatorship in Europe. The dissidents used many of the same techniques of imagery, sloganeering, and mobilization pioneered by the Otpor movement in Serbia to topple Slobodan Milosevic, those methods since employed elsewhere to cultivate foreign media and subvert domestic propaganda, were to no avail. President Alexander Lukashenko was reelected with 83% of the vote. Even accounting for the widespread fraud reported by international monitors, polling represented something less than wholesale popular enthusiasm for democracy. But Andrew Miller, who reported on the election for The Economist magazine, says both the outcome and the political background have been mischaracterized.
I think the label "the last dictatorship in Europe," which is a popular one in the press, is a little bit misleading. The regime in Belarus is nasty and degrading and dismal for its opponents. But the truth is that Mr. Lukashenko, whilst eccentric and almost comic in some of his habits and his propaganda, it is remarkably popular amongst people in Belarus for reasons which bespeak a certain poverty of ambition, a tragic poverty of ambition, you could say. He provides pensions which have increased slightly over the last decade and are paid regularly. And average incomes in Belarus have risen to the stellar heights of around $200 a month. But for people in that part of the world who've seen the economic strife in the neighboring countries since the collapse of the Soviet Union, those achievements seem much less humble than they do to us.
Well, notwithstanding the level of stability enjoyed by Belarusians, there's still the fact that it's an authoritarian regime, and the trend has been for those to eventually collapse. It certainly happened with Milosevic, and it happened in Ukraine with the so-called Orange Revolution. Why were democracy advocates so pitifully unsuccessful in the election?
I don't think it was reasonable to expect 200,000 people to come into the streets in the way they did in Kiev in 2004. But I think the opposition has achieved something in this campaign. They've raised their own profile. And if you look at what happened in Ukraine, there were widespread protests against the then Kuchma regime in 2001, which failed to topple the regime. But what happened was the opposition went away, learned from its experience, regrouped, took advice from overseas, came back a few years later and finished the job.
One advantage the Ukrainian demonstrators had was at least semi-free media that they could exploit. That's clearly not the case in Belarus. Give me a background, please, on the state of media there and what anti-government forces were able to do to subvert the propaganda.
The way that information, real information, circulates is not dissimilar from the late Soviet period. Small circulation publications which have to circulate surreptitiously because they can't be distributed by official channels. And as for television, I was there a couple of weeks ago on a day when a man called Mr. Kazulin, who was another opposition candidate, was beaten up by some of Mr. Lukashenko's thugs. And on TV, the incident was portrayed as a provocation staged by Mr. Kazulin in collaboration with conniving foreign journalists who were in attendance.
And of course, behind the vile myth, there's probably at least an element of truth. I imagine the CIA and Western NGOs and groups such as Otpor have, in fact, put some money and effort into helping create some sort of democratic opposition in Belarus.
Well, if they have, they haven't been all that successful. There were many differences with the revolution in Kiev. One of them was that there was a lot of money there. There was a big stage. There were rock bands playing every night throughout the standoff in the snow for a few weeks. There was free food and warm clothes for the protesters. It was a big, well-organized and very well-funded opposition. In Minsk this week, on the first night of the protest, which was the biggest night, the most important night, Mr. Milinkevich, the main opposition candidate, had to address the crowd through a sort of little megaphone. Most people couldn't even hear what he was saying. Now there's a little encampment in this square in Minsk. But it's nothing like the scale that it was in Kiev. And I think funding, you know, is definitely one of the problems for the opposition.
Belarus is not a huge country. There's something like 10 million people. And I don't know how high the stakes are perceived to be in the corridors of Western power. But do you think the international press has done a good job in covering what's going on there?
I think they have. And given that it's a small landlocked country which does virtually no trade with America, doesn't have a powerful army or nuclear weapons or anything like that, I think the coverage of it has been pretty good. And it's been important as well in the last few days during these protests in Minsk. Were it not for the presence of quite a large number of foreign correspondents and especially television crews, it's possible that there would have been some nasty violence perpetrated against these protesters by the riot police who've been massing in the side streets around this square where they're protesting. And in the square, one of the chants that the protesters have struck up has been "thank you to the journalists," which is not something you hear all that often. And the journalists, of course, are partly there because they expect something nasty to happen to the protesters. So far it hasn't. And let's hope it remains that way, although, of course, journalists aren't going to stay there forever and will decamp, especially because there is an election in neighboring Ukraine this weekend. So it could be that when they do leave, the riot police go into action. Well, they haven't yet, so that's at least encouraging.
Okay, Andrew. Well, thank you very, very much.
Okay, no problem.
Andrew Miller is a reporter for The Economist magazine. We spoke to him on Thursday. A few hours later, Belarusian security forces entered the primary encampment of democratic protesters in a Minsk square and took all of them into custody. Serge Popovic, a veteran of Serbia's Otpor movement, is founder of the Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies in Belgrade. He says the measure of the Belarus opposition's success is not this election, nor necessarily even the next.
One problem with world media is that they are only, you know, recording the final act. Half a million people on the street getting inside the parliament and the television, and boom, Milosevic is finished. That was not that way. The nonviolent struggle in Serbia lasted for 10 years, and we had so many successes and failures in this struggle.
Of course, as we both know, the reason the press is not attracted to the process is because you can't take pictures of a process. You can only take pictures of an event. What do you advise democracy organizations to keep the press interested when there's very little of great interest to photograph?
There is always something to take picture of. And in Serbia, we were creating hundreds of small actions which were very, very good-looking and sending a very strong visual messages. And these pictures from these small protests, small public actions, street theaters, groups of women bringing flowers to the police, they were all around the world. So these small media victories can be achieved through very small, limited, low-risk, symbolic actions. And there are always good ideas for this action.
The Lukashenko regime is characterizing the protests in Belarus as the work of outside spies and agitators, that it's a conspiracy of the West to take away the Belarusian sovereignty and way of life. A message which I gather has had some resonance, especially in the rural areas. They're buying the propaganda. In some ways, the success of Otpor is coming back to haunt the activists in Belarus. Are your Belarusian compatriots victims of your success?
Well, this is the very important question. Every non-democratic regime is playing on the card of nationalism in a way that it wants to portray the democratic opposition as mercenaries and national traitors. Serbian opposition was not only labeled as the puppets of the West, but also in the last stages of his power as a terrorist. And you can see even the language is repeated by Lukashenko now. But there is a great lesson learned here in Serbia. To get to the people and to wash their brains from the state propaganda, you must play the card of patriotism. In Serbia, the main slogan of Otpor for months and months was that resistance because I love Serbia. And if you look to what people in Belarus are doing, it's pretty similar. I mean, look at the flags. These are very old Belarusian flags. Look at the Saturday, the day they pick. It's the anniversary of the old state. So it's pretty obvious that they're playing the same card to prove that they're a homegrown movement and that they're working on a common good of the people of Belarus, not for the foreign interest.
The fact is, though, that Western governments and non-governmental organizations pour millions of dollars into burgeoning democracy movements, a fact that, of course, helps the local movements, but also gives the regime ammunition to portray the protesters as enemies of the state. How do you respond? Do you deny it? Do you embrace it? What do you do?
Regime will always do it, whether it is truthful or not. So you need to have the clear answer. The less secret you keep, it is the biggest possibility that you will create regime propaganda uncredible. One of the very important things for the movements in field is that they need to cultivate the international support. But international organizations, often with the money, are also trying to bring their own agenda, their own interests, and their own favorites in the battlefield. You need to learn how to avoid this, like we did in Serbia. If you are fundraising to international organizations, it should be strictly directed to your homegrown agenda purpose.
Well, Serge, thank you so much.
No problem.
Serge Popovic is founder of the Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies in Belgrade, Serbia. For nations scarred by war crimes, disappearances, and other violent repression, it's been described as the last resort for justice, the International War Crimes Trial. It's often the only recourse available when the international community wants to bring its legal weight to bear on perpetrators of mass violence, and as such, it has come to be a catch-all, performing many roles for many people. Part media spectacle, part history lesson, part political scorecard, part attempt at truth and reconciliation, the trials have evolved into a messy media phenomenon, one that has become, with the creation of the International Criminal Court in 2002, an established part of the global order. Anthony Dworkin is a former journalist who now directs Crimes of War, an organization that connects journalists, lawyers, and scholars to raise public awareness about the laws of war. He joins us now. Anthony, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
We have seen quite a number of trials of late, including that of former Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic in The Hague and Saddam Hussein's prosecution in Baghdad. But I guess the standard set for all subsequent war crimes trials was the Tribunal for Nazi War Criminals at Nuremberg. What made Nuremberg work so well?
Well, I think you're right. Nuremberg was and remains the point of reference for all of these war crimes trials. The prosecutors at Nuremberg had some tremendous advantages that later prosecutors, I think, would be very jealous of. One of them goes back to the very kind of systematic, bureaucratic nature of the Nazi regime. They had a tremendous mass of evidence. And one of the problems that we've seen throughout some of these later war crimes trials is the higher up you go in the chain of command, the harder it is to prove a direct connection to the crimes. And then the other thing, when you're talking about public perceptions about the validity of the trial, the legitimacy of the process, there was a situation there where the Nazi regime had been comprehensively defeated. And so there was really no legitimacy left. They weren't really contending with a kind of large group who still thought somehow that the Nazis should be there.
Now, my memory of Nuremberg is based entirely on the film Judgment at Nuremberg.
It is not easy to tell the truth, but if there is to be any salvation for Germany, we who know our guilt must admit it, whatever the pain and humiliation. It was not a trial at all. It was a sacrificial ritual.
But what about contemporaneous coverage? How did the world public witness the Nuremberg trials?
Newsreel coverage was the most important way that it was seen, particularly outside Germany. In addition, it was covered on radio and it was covered extensively in the press. One important point to remember is that the first trial, the one that we all think of as the Nuremberg trials, it just ran a matter of months, unlike some of the war crimes trials that we've seen since then, which have been much more drawn out and therefore harder to cover from a media point of view.
And is it that protracted nature of subsequent commissions and trials that, in your view, have made subsequent prosecutions just less successful than Nuremberg?
Well, I think we should qualify that by saying that in some ways our expectations of these trials is a lot higher now than it was in Nuremberg. You know, there's a tendency, I think, for war crimes trials very quickly to be labeled either as a farce or as a circus. That's a narrative that seems to write itself very easily nowadays. And yet, if you go back and look at what happened at Nuremberg, there were many aspects of the Nuremberg trial that, if they were taking place today, we would be very quick to criticize. For instance, at one point they charged the wrong defendant by mistake. And then, of course, in a way, a much more serious point, is that the Soviet Union was one of the prosecuting nations, and yet they'd been responsible for many similar crimes that the Germans were being tried for.
The most recent slate of war crimes trials began in 1993 when the United Nations began to try perpetrators in the former Yugoslavia. What was the goal here? Was it jurisprudence? Was it politics, history, reconciliation, show business? What?
The Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal, which is really the kind of the beginning of the modern wave of international criminal justice, was set up almost by default. You know, I think it was a feeling like there must be some sort of retribution for these kinds of things. We can't just stand by and endorse them. So we're not going to intervene to stop them, but we're going to register our disapproval. And at the same time, coming as it did after the end of the Cold War, when there was this new feeling that the international community and the United Nations had to mean something. I think there was a new belief in the possibility of international law. But what we've seen as the court developed is that it had a lot of different audiences. One question was that of establishing a historical record, determining who really had committed these crimes. Were they genocide? Another question was it going to help the process of peace and reconciliation? That was what the Security Council said it was doing when it set up the court. It has been very important for the victims and for the witnesses who've testified there. And then another effect that it's had is simply in taking people out of the picture on the ground by making them into prisoners or making them go on the run.
Both the Milosevic and the Saddam Hussein prosecutions have given us the bonus feature of long screeds, the defendant in the dock railing against the powers arrayed against him. I gather this is something we can look forward to as long as we have despots in the dock.
I do think that this is an inevitable aspect of these things, where in contrast to a trial within a normal domestic jurisdiction, you have a defendant who is very likely to reject the legitimacy of the court altogether and reject any notion that it's a kind of objective process. And then the balance that has to be struck is between letting them take over and appearing to shut them down and not give them a fair chance to speak. When it comes to the appearance of due process, you have to be pretty strict with that.
Given these defendants such liberal use of the bully pulpit, can these trials actually undermine the goal of shedding light on a dark chapter of history?
I think what happens is somehow it doesn't run as smoothly as people had hoped. And therefore, at a time when there still isn't consensus about what these things are supposed to be doing, people can then go to the opposite extreme and fall very easily into this narrative of it's a farce, forgetting that they're dealing with the aftermath of atrocities committed on a massive scale, defendants who reject the legitimacy of the court. And if you look at the International Criminal Court, which is going to be the new body dealing with these things, they're very aware of this. They've put quite a lot of effort into outreach and establishing the legitimacy of the tribunal.
All right. Anthony, thank you so much.
Sure.
Anthony Dworkin is the director of crimesofwar.org. Coming up, the president plays rope-a-dope with the media filter and license plates as a license for self-expression. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. With his approval ratings in free fall, the president launched a public relations offensive this week, appearing at various forums to take questions from citizens, military families, and the press. Wait, the press? The media filter he's been working around for almost 6 years? What an odd way to burnish his image, opening himself up to questions, or screeds, like this one.
I'd like to ask you, Mr. President, your decision to invade Iraq has caused the deaths of thousands of Americans and Iraqis, wounds of Americans and Iraqis for a lifetime. Every reason given, publicly at least, has turned out not to be true. My question is, why did you really want to go to war?
That was Helen Thomas talking to President Bush. New York Newsday's conservative columnist James Pinkerton put forth a theory about that exchange in his Thursday column, and he joins me now to discuss it. Jim, welcome to OTM.
Thank you. The theory, of course, is that the president knew exactly what he was going to get when he called upon Helen Thomas to ask him a question. She is well known as noisy and extremely hostile to President Bush and the Republicans. So why then would he want a question from her? And the answer, I think, is that he was using her as a foil.
In other words, to tell his base and other Americans that, see what I've been telling you all along? This is what I'm up against. There's no way you're going to get the straight dope about Iraq or anything else.
Exactly. Bush kept a sense of humor, didn't lose his cool, was nice about it, but let the press show off that they can be kind of scruffy and obnoxious. Now, of course, the press isn't running for anything. It's not their job to be smooth and rounded in their conversations and tones and so on. So Helen Thomas or David Gregory of NBC News can be obnoxious. But if they let themselves become the issue, such as they begin on the national stage, then I think it's the president's further hope that people will conflate a somewhat obnoxious, feisty press with the Democratic Party. And if that happens, then the Democrats are in deep trouble, because if people have to choose between left and right in this country, they usually choose right.
So what you're suggesting is this isn't an isolated incident, that the strategy is to goad the president's opponents, whether they be in the press or in the Democratic Party, to further attack him and just to seem extreme and unreasonable and out of the mainstream.
Right. In the short run, if President Bush is attacked by nothing but David Gregory and Helen Thomas and anybody else who wants to ask beanball questions in these press availabilities on TV, that only helps the president look moderate and heroic to his own base. I think the real test will come down the road. If, for lack of a better term, Thomasism, sort of the descendant of McGovernism, if the Democrats get so energized and angry about the war, and if they think that President Bush is to them what Richard Nixon was to Democrats 3.5 decades ago, then the paradox they might face is that the Democrats nominate a candidate in response who can't get elected. He or she is so far to the left that he or she is unelectable. That's what happened to the Democrats in 1972, and I'm convinced that Richard Nixon was a smart enough guy to realize that if he and Spiro Agnew stirred the pot back and forth with protesters and demonstrators and liberals and Democrats and so on back then, that the Democrats would take the bait and nominate somebody who couldn't get elected. In the final analysis, if it's a battle of the bases, the Republicans benefit.
All right, Jim. Well, thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you.
Jim Pinkerton is a columnist for New York's Newsday. Used to be, a license plate was a license plate. But in 1987, the state of Florida started offering a special plate to commemorate the Space Shuttle Challenger. That idea took off, and today drivers around the country can, for a few extra bucks, choose plates celebrating hundreds of organizations and pet causes. Tennessee has nearly 100 plate options, representing everything from college fraternities to Vietnam veterans to amateur radio enthusiasts. And thanks to a ruling last week by the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, Tennesseans are about to have one more choice. It features the phrase, "Choose Life." Abortion rights supporters had challenged the plate, accusing the government of discriminating against opposing viewpoints, but the court said that because the message amounted to, quote, government speech, it passed constitutional muster. Joining me now is David Hudson, an attorney with the First Amendment Center in Nashville. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
First of all, government speech, that is a formulation I had not heard before. Tell me what it means.
Government speech essentially means that the government itself has its own First Amendment rights and that the government can promote certain messages, such as stop smoking or don't drive drunk or, in this case, choose life.
But as I understand it, this is the first time an appeals court has agreed with the government speech defense in one of these license plate cases.
Right. This decision by the Sixth Circuit directly conflicts with the Fourth Circuit's decision from a couple years ago, in which the Fourth Circuit held that when a state does issue a specialty license plate of Choose Life, that the government is not totally promoting its own message, but also facilitating private speakers to speak their message.
Let me see if I've got this right. If the speech is deemed primarily private, then it would be unconstitutional to discriminate against one viewpoint over another. But if it's held to be government speech, then it gets a free pass.
That is the primary and chief legal distinction. Is this government speech or is this private speech?
Now, to me, the confounding thing about that majority opinion, if you buy the principle of government speech to begin with, is that the sponsor of this Choose Life message in the Tennessee case was a local anti-abortion group. And not only was it the sponsor of the message, it actually received a cut of the proceeds from Tennesseans who ordered the plate. And furthermore, this was the group that actually appealed a lower court decision that found against the Choose Life message. So it seems like kind of a stretch just on the facts.
Well, you've made a compelling argument that it's not truly government speech. The one caveat to that is our new Chief Justice, John G. Roberts Jr., has in the past been a strong advocate of the government speech doctrine. So if it does go up eventually for Supreme Court review, I think Chief Justice Roberts might very well view this as government speech.
Let's say the High Court does take the case, but rules in favor of the Fourth Circuit's private speech interpretation. That would render this kind of message unconstitutional unless states agreed to print special plates for all viewpoints. Could there be a free-for-all brewing here?
Those who support the government speech doctrine will make that argument that if it truly becomes a designated public forum in which the state opens up government property for the expression of private views, then the government generally can't discriminate based on viewpoint. The state would have to allow almost any message. And that, in a sense, gives the government speech argument some force here because many people don't want to see a free-for-all.
Now, all of these plates begin life in the respective state legislature. So it's not as though I have a point of view that I want to express, whether about abortion or anything else, and I just go to the DMV and say, I want a special plate on this. Someone has to introduce legislation in the state legislature, and it has to pass, and then the plates start getting printed up.
That's generally how it works. In fact, the legislature considered both Choose Life and pro-choice and decided to go with the Choose Life. If you apply the government speech doctrine, then the government can pick and choose.
There is one case in which the Supreme Court has weighed in on a license plate issue, not a special plate, actually a standard issue plate by the state of New Hampshire that said live free or die. Tell me the particulars there.
George Maynard believed, for religious reasons, that live free or die was against his personal beliefs, and he continued to cover up the motto and continued to receive citations for it. The case eventually reached the United States Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Woolley versus Maynard that the state could not compel George Maynard to agree with a principle that he personally disagreed with.
Which would appear to be a big, fat, juicy Supreme Court precedent, but in fact, I guess these special plates are in no way compelled because people actually order them. They volunteer to have them.
Absolutely. That was another interesting aspect of Judge Rogers' decision in the Sixth Circuit is he cited Woolley in support of his position, which is interesting.
You seem to suggest a judicial non sequitur. Is that what you're saying?
I think that you could come to another conclusion.
All right. Well, your diplomacy is appreciated. David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
David Hudson is an attorney with the First Amendment Center in Nashville. The idea of license plates as a medium does not end with prepackaged sloganeering. Until blogs first appeared, these plates were probably the nation's number one venue for self-expression, permitting, for example, every VW Cabriolet driver in the country to personalize her tags with some variant of QT Pi. It's a uniquely American phenomenon we first explored on this program 5 years ago. The other day, I was stuck in traffic in Northern Virginia, where I live, and in front of me was a car with the following license plate. B-U-T-T-H-D. Virginia is for lovers. Nobody ever said anything about self-esteem. For me, though, this was an epiphany. The Internet may well be a tool of mass expression, but it certainly isn't unprecedented.
L-O-A-N-W-U-F.
Lone Wolf. I'm a senior loan officer for Bronner Mortgage here in Fairfax.
Fly kites. Fly kites you do?
Yes.
Why do you want everybody else to know?
I go to a lot of kite festivals.
We got caught up into it and thought, hey, why not? So I got Big Red and my husband got Big Mac.
Vanity plates. Long before there was an internet, there was an interstate net of license tag message boards as analog as can be.
H-A-R-T-A-A-U. Mm-hmm. Heart of gold, right?
Heart of gold.
What's it all about?
Well, I was actually inspired by the Hitchhiker's Guide series, Zaphod Beeblebrox and his starship Heart of Gold.
And this is something you think the rest of the world should know?
Oh, absolutely. I am Zaphod Beeblebrox.
And I am really scared right now.
Names, initials, job descriptions, hobbies, you literally name it. Virginia has 781,000 vanity plates active at the moment, representing more than 12% of vehicle registrations.
And that's about the highest in the country.
University of Richmond economics professor Eric Kraft says Virginia may or may not be more autobiographical than other states, but it's certainly cheaper. The nominal $10 added fee, he says, drives the business.
Oh, well, there's still millions of dollars involved, so I wouldn't call it trivial.
Anyway, the money isn't trivial. There's also the question of subject matter. Commissioner of Motor Vehicles, Rick Holcomb.
I love just riding down the road and looking at plates and trying to figure out something about that person. Maybe where did they go to school? When did they graduate? What's their profession? What sports team do they root for?
Yeah, and what kind of car they drive. A stunningly common vanity plate concept is to document the make of the vehicle bolted to the license tag. My Benz, my Jag, my BMW, my God, my Kia. And motorists will go to all sorts of tortured lengths, where the correct spellings have been snapped up, to phonetically approximate the sound, like KRVT for Corvette. Virginians can use the DMV website to experiment with letter combinations and order online. Jamie Haybecker of the department's Web Services Division shows off this message generator.
Once they've found one that is available, it'll tell them, congratulations, the message you've requested is available. Or it will tell them that it's not available and they can try another combination.
For instance, ugly is taken. I-M-E-Z is taken. Rufus, Doofus, and Goofus are all taken. Although I'm pleased to report that yeast, felon, and gum disease are all wide open. Job references, of course, are very popular. Butcher and baker, for instance. Foot doc, eye doc, kid doc, and naturally DDS are long gone. The profession to have if you want to exploit unspoken for obviousness is accounting. Audit, for example, is available. Your taxes is available. W-2-4-U, inexplicably, is available.
Type into there for me, please. LIFO, L-I-F-O.
Last in, first out. Message is available.
What does it say to you about the state of creativity among Commonwealth of Virginia accountants that LIFO and FIFO are both available?
Maybe they're just not a terribly imaginative group.
Precisely. Like the World Wide Web it predated, the vanity plate universe, and not just the accounting part of it, is mainly a vast wasteland of the shockingly unimaginative, the unclever, and the excruciatingly banal. That is, except when the challenge is to be truly vile at 60 miles per hour. Here, creativity blooms. For example, the plate THSO seems innocuous until it is spied in your rearview mirror. Oh, my. Needless to say, as you work that one out in your mind's eye, the state takes a dim view of objectionable material. Vanity plate messages are speech. They are not necessarily protected speech. Commissioner Holcomb.
I do not believe the plate to be a First Amendment forum. It is state property. I guess I would look at a license plate much the same way as the U.S. Post Office will look at a stamp.
Right, and stamps are imprinted with flags and flowers and the Virgin Mary and Elvis, not the words lick me. So, lick me and poop on you and I'm a hoe and much, much, much worse are on a list of the 6,000-plus words you cannot say on your GT. And the list grows every day as state employees actually conjugate vulgarities to anticipate subsequent distasteful permutations. But look, there is licentious license behavior, and there is romance. Consider Professor Eric Kraft, the economist.
My first vanity plate from about 5 years ago is SVEV.
That, as you know, is an erotic Scandinavian folk dance.
Since there aren't a whole lot of Scandinavians down here in Richmond, I thought I would sort of put something Swedish or Norwegian on my plate and see if anyone might come tap my window or stop by sometime when I was, or wave at me.
Are you trying to pick up women with Svev?
I'm trying to actually catch anyone's interest who has an interest in Swedish folk dance and culture.
And if that person were a Nordic goddess, so much the better.
Well, that would be fine.
Okay, the total today is $97.
Can you just read that back to me so I know I have it, the
plate number? It'll be W2 space with the logo in the middle for you.
All right, that's perfect. Thank you.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Ani Katz and Mark Phillips. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR. Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at wnyc.org. And thanks.